Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. This week's interview is with Stu Mashewitz. Mike Seymour talks to him about the feature film, The Spirit. The Spirit is a Frank Miller graphic novel along the line of Sin City 300, and it also marks his directorial debut. Stu is the author of DV Rebel, and really no stranger around these parts. The DV Rebel book, we worked closely with him on doing a class version for one of our terms of FX PhD, and the DV Rebel book is pretty much considered a standard for independent filmmakers and people trying to get started making independent films. He served as senior visual effects supervisor and second unit director for the movie The Spirit. You also may know him from appearances on Red Center, podcast here at FX Guide. He also has the ProLost blog, which you'll have to check out. It's prolost.blogspot.com, or if you just type in ProLost in Google, actually, I think it comes up first. Anyway, Mike and Stu talk about accomplishing 1,900 shots for The Spirit, visual effects shots. A lot of real technical talk about working with the Genesis camera on set. A great term is discussed, green screen psychosis. The theory of Stu's about people's reaction to green screen on a set, which I think is fascinating. Also talking about tracking markers with lasers, self-illuminated tracking markers. And just a great conversation in general about the complexities of supervising such a multi-vendor show. Kind of the realities of visual effects movies these days are that they have to be done by multiple vendors. They're just too big. And when you get to 1,900 shots, you know, not many facilities can handle that many shots on their own. So, you know, dealing with the data, moving those shots around, the color issues are stuff that obviously you'd expect Stu to be very passionate about and very involved with. So let's jump now to the interview with Mike and Stu.
So, Stu, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Glad to be here.
So in your famous DV Rebel guide to action filmmaking, you discussed that your first preference isn't to use green screen, but obviously you found yourself on a primarily green screen film with this. How did that come about?
Well, yeah, it's true that I recommend against green screen use for the DV Rebel. I had, of course, worked with Frank Miller once before on Sin City and with Robert Rodriguez there and on some prior green screen endeavors. So I've been... You know, I've worked on productions that have been green screen based and where everything has been done, you know, as it should. But, you know, all of them are in their own way utilizing that for a creative reason as well as a technical one, you know, it's hard. And I think it's hard to achieve good results that way. And I think there's a phenomenon that I talk about often, which I call green screen psychosis, where painting something green is perceived by people on a set as sort of rendering it completely invisible, and as we've discussed, you know, kind of the process of removing it or replacing it with something is I think generally thought of as being a much simpler process than it really is. That's always my concern with having an abundance of green screen on the set, is that here you have this amazing crew of filmmakers, you know, because everyone on a movie set is a skilled collaborator in the filmmaking process and brings unique creative and executional insights to the process, and they're standing around staring at something that basically says nothing you're doing matters, where it's all going to be taken care of later. So despite the fact that, you know, in our Albuquerque stages for filming The Spirit, we had a 360-degree room filled with green, we also had stages lined with black. We had a white screen that we shot on occasionally. We would, wherever possible, use as little green screen as we could, even though, you know, a good 60% of the movie might be nothing but green screen. And we did, of course, build some sets as well. So even in our own way, even making a movie that really is the best case scenario for a green screen endeavor, we used it as little as possible.
Well, I mean, one of the things you had working for you was the DOP, because he's extremely experienced in, you know, shooting for visual effects.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, when I found out that they were bringing Bill Pope on board, that was when I really started to get excited about the collaborative effort that was going to happen on this movie, because Bill is, you know, not just experienced with the technical demands, but he also has a cinematographer sensibility that in a lot of ways is compatible and maybe even the filmic equivalent of Frank Miller's graphical style.
Yeah, and there were an enormous amount of shots, because if I'm right, the shot count got up into like over 1,900, right?
That's correct, all told, although there's only about 1,800 in the final film. You know, you do more than that because you're working on maybe a larger section of shots for, you know, before the film is completely trimmed down, or you're making, you know, trailers and alternate versions for director's cuts and things like that. So yeah, the film all told has about 1,800 some odd shots in it, but we created over 1,900 shots for the film.
Now, of course, you worked on Sin City, and I read interestingly that at the beginning of this film, you discussed the fact with the sort of other members of the filmmaking, because you were on very early, that you were sort of seeing this obviously in a linear line from Sin City and 300, but you wanted to sort of go into different areas. Tell me how this differed from, say, Sin City.
Well, one of the fun things of Sin City for me was the opportunity. You know, I was a huge fan of the books. I really felt that they were the ultimate expression of Frank Miller's unique graphical style, his visual minimalism that I just admire so much. He tells such an amazingly huge amount of story with an image that is very sparse, and that leaves quite a lot to the imagination. You know, Robert Rodriguez was very reverential to that, and in making Sin City, wanted to really just put those images up on the screen in as much as we could. And you know, I think Frank, in the course of shooting Sin City, was the one who kind of wanted to experiment and try different things, and Robert was the one who kind of put his foot down and said, no, we're going to really, you know, honor the comic books whether you want to or not. You know, that was the interesting dynamic between the two of them there. So getting to at the beginning of this process, one of the, you know, as I started to talk with Frank more and more, one of the great discoveries for me was just what a huge fan of film he is. You know, he's a great lover of cinema, and in particular, you know, we shared a lot of love in common for some older films, some black and white films, and some film noir. So, you know, Frank was very interested, as was Bill Pope and as was I, whereas I think we all kind of agreed that, you know, Sin City had been putting the comic book on the screen, so to speak, and that in a way so had 300, but with a different style of, you know, comic book artwork, something much more colorful and much more like an oil painting. With the Spirit, we had an opportunity to make a movie and to find the cinematic ways of creating images on the screen that would have the same kind of emotional impact that you would expect from Frank Miller artwork without necessarily being slavish to the specifics of what makes a Frank Miller comic book page.
Yeah, and you were on very early because, in fact, obviously you had the role of visual effects supervisor, but also you ended up doing a second unit directing, and you really were a collaborator from very early on, weren't you?
Yeah, it was a real, you know, I mean, obviously just the opportunity of a lifetime to be able to collaborate in that way. I think, you know, there was kind of a triumvirate there between Frank and Bill and myself in the visual arena, and then also the producer, Deborah Del Pret, who is just an amazing filmmaker in her own right and worked really well with Frank on developing the script. You know, they built a great system. They surrounded themselves with people who were going to be passionate about, you know, doing their part and working together to make this thing, because it is Frank's, you know, solo directorial debut, and as everyone who's ever sat anywhere near that chair knows, you don't do this stuff alone.
I guess the other person that must have been key was your producer at the Orphanage, because the amount of stuff that the Orphanage had to process, and that's a heck of a lot of shots.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Our producer at the Orphanage is Nancy St. John, and she's got a tremendous amount of experience in the industry, and I just, absolutely, we could not have done this without her. We developed a lot of really cool systems for making this project work, and she gets all the credit for, you know, just building and executing that, you know, this command center that we built at the orphanage for overseeing all of this work. She made it effortless for me. It was a luxurious experience for me to be able to walk in the door every day and make only creative decisions, never have to worry about the operational end of it. I just can't say enough about what an amazing team she had and just how uniquely gifted she is in putting a production like that together.
So let's just talk about it from a technical point of view for a sec. This film was interestingly shot on the Genesis camera, though I believe you also used the Phantom, is that right, for some high-speed stuff?
That's correct, yeah. We made the decision early on that we were going to shoot the whole thing in some digital format or the other, and it didn't take Bill Pope and I long to settle on the Genesis as our camera of choice. But yeah, we also then did bring on the Phantom for the high-speed work, of which there's plenty, including one sequence that really hinged entirely on it, where we have a fairly long sequence in the beginning of the film that is entirely takes place entirely underwater and was entirely shot dry for wet, with the high-speed camera underwater lighting effects and, you know, fans blowing to simulate the look of being underwater.
Yeah, I've seen some stuff from that, and that underwater stuff looks incredible. I mean, tell me, was there any difference in the way that you approached the digital files? Because I know that you had an on-set LUT system so as to be able to give a more accurate understanding. Was there a difference between how you dealt with the Genesis and how you dealt with the Phantom from a on-set point of view?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the live preview that you have of the Phantom is much more akin to kind of a Rec. 709 video output. So it didn't make sense to use the same LUTs that we used for the Genesis. On the Genesis side, Bill staged, I think, about 3 test shoots where he and I tried out green screen versus blue screen. We tried out different makeup tests, and at the same time we're developing what we would kind of base our color correction ideas around, a signature LUT that we would shoot the entire film to. We started off calling it the MASH, and it was MASH 1, MASH 2, and we eventually settled on MASH 4, which kind of gives you a sense of how, it wasn't like we went through 30 or 100 variations on this thing. We went through four of them. Before we kind of settled on this high contrast, low color saturation, but certainly not black and white look. So by the time we began principal photography, we actually had a Genesis LUT that we trusted empirically, that we had run through the entire pipeline. And it wasn't just a LUT where we turned some knobs and said, yeah, this looks okay. It was a LUT that actually took the image pipeline all the way out to film out. So it had a Kodak 2383 print emulation built into it that was designed to be looked at on Sony broadcast HD monitors.
So just to be clear about that, though, we're talking about a LUT that was only a display LUT on the feed to the tent, or was this actually playing with the curves in the Genesis?
No, in fact, as far as I know, there are no curves in the Genesis to be played with. This was all non-destructively applied,
right,
to the previewing of the image. Yeah, the images that we recorded to SR tape were just the raw panelog. But the way that we spec'd out the video preview on the set was such that all of the down converts, all of the playback, everything that anyone ever saw, with the exception of, you know, the on-camera LCD and 2 monitors that were hidden in a tent, everything had the LUT on it. So, and that was something that I wanted to do for Frank, to give him the luxury of seeing an image that was as close to the final product as possible. But it paid out in spades for everyone else, too, for makeup artists and wardrobe and set designers to be able to just put something out in front of a camera and see exactly how it might look in the theater. That wound up being a pretty amazing experience for everybody, and it just gave everyone a lot of confidence in what we were doing, and at the same time, I also built into that on-set LUT something that we took out for the final film, of course, which was the green screen suppression. So I was able to on-set suppress the green screen to gray or black or white. We had a choice between the three, and that just meant that you know, again, in my perennial effort to try to minimize the visual sort of seasickness that comes from being surrounded by so much green, at the very least, the images on the monitors, the actors were standing in front of a gray or black or white backdrop instead of green. It helped to minimize the green screen psychosis and get us a little bit closer to an image that might be more akin to what would be in the final film.
What were you doing that with, a Luther box, or how were you actually, what was the mechanics of having those monitors lighted?
It's a small box that Panavision actually makes. I believe they call it the GDP, Genesis Display something,
right.
Something. And it just stores a small handful of LUTs, I think four or five of them. We had, in addition to our Mesh 4, you know, green to gray, green to black, green to white, we also had two silhouette LUTs that we could turn on so that we could actually take anything that was green and make it white, take anything that wasn't green and make it black, except for anything that was red, which we would make pure red. And that way you could actually take Gabriel Macht, who plays the Spirit, in his wardrobe and just walk him out in front of the camera with his, black lightable fluorescent red tie, and you'd have a real-time Frank Miller drawing on your HD monitor on the set. It was always good fun when we could turn on that LUT.
Obviously a scale of this, you know, film, you really paid a lot of attention to getting your green screen right. On Superman Returns, I believe that they discovered that shooting significantly hotter green screen than was normally a film kind of mantra worked in spades for them. So they were actually shooting the levels higher on the green screen. What was sort of, I mean, a textbook case would say shoot your green screen at 50 IRE. Were you over-lighting your green screen to help with King and Genesis?
Well, you know, we did test that, and because I think at the time that we were doing our original camera test, that was when those discoveries were fresh in everyone's mind. I am still troubled a little bit by that philosophy of overexposing the green screen. I think that when everything is firing on all cylinders, it can work fine, but I also think that there's a little bit of a false promise there. I think sometimes those keys pull a little quicker and have less noise in them because, in fact, the green channel is oversaturating. And that might, at first blush, give you the impression that you're pulling a richer key, but, in fact, you're doing so at the expense of some edge detail. Since we had most of our movie is featuring characters in dark black wardrobe, I wanted to be able to hold on to every last little bit of edge detail in our motion blur. We also had actresses with diaphanous wardrobe. We had a lot, and I was going to be also trying to capture things like muzzle flashes and smoke that coming off of prop guns and things like that. So we did do the test. I did discuss with Bill the idea of overexposing the green screen by just one stop, and then we had the realistic conversation that would in fact double his lighting budget, because we were taking a stage the size of a football field and going 360 degree and leaving image 80s in place, like on the floor and on the ceiling, lighting the entire thing so that at any time we could flip a switch and have, in fact, two stages completely greened out. So ultimately, luckily, my trepidation about relying on that overexposing the green screen dovetailed nicely with the budgetary concerns of having twice as much green light at our fingertips at any given time.
And did you light that tungsten or daylight? Because some digital cameras respond much better to daylight.
I believe that we balanced everything to tungsten.
Really?
That just shows you the faith that we have in the Genesis. I mean, I think we lit everything to the native Genesis balance, and I believe that's tungsten. this is the benefit of shooting these tests, right, is that you go into it at least with some, you know, confidence that you've tested. You know, we tested blonde hair, dark wardrobe, flapping in the breeze, fluorescently lit red ties. We had, you know, several kind of worst case scenarios happening at once in front of this green screen. So our test came back and we had positive results with the formula that we settled on.
And I was going to say you were shooting for about 48 days. Is that right? The shoot.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So tell me about the role the orphanage took in post-production, because you weren't providing editorial, but were you providing the DI?
Yeah, that's correct. We actually did provide the DI. We had just installed our Nucota Filmmaster system. You know, the orphanage has a history of doing digital color correction for movies even before it was called DI, back in the days when people first began shooting movies on DV cameras. We had a little bit of a business that at the time was called Magic Bullet, and which, of course, has evolved into a software product. In fact, my the colorist who has been with the company since our very early days in 1999 was my associate visual effects supervisor on the film, which was a big role because effectively I spent all my time on the second unit directing, and so the associate supervisor, Aaron Rhodes, spent all of his time on the main unit kind of doing my job. And then he went on to be our DI colorist on the film throughout all of post. And
in fact, wasn't Aaron nicknamed Stu too?
That is exactly right. Yes, they began to call him Stu too. And he and I had monitors on our sets so that we could spy on what each other was doing and talk to each other and that kind of thing. It was a great collaboration. But one of the really cool things about it was to have someone who is involved from the earliest stages in conversations with the DP and is in fact sitting next to him every day on the set, then goes on to become the colorist on the film. And, you know, as I've written about before on my blog, I have a real concern about the way that visual effects intermingles or doesn't with the DI process as more and more films are relying on visual effects in the way that I think they should, you know, in the way that I wrote about in my book, and in the way that is sort of integrated and not treating them as a post-production thing, but really treating them as a general kind of part of the problem solving that you start thinking about even in pre-production. You know, visual effects are becoming indispensable in defining the look and content of every kind of movie, not just, you know, visual effects tentpole kind of films. And then in turn, the DI is now, I think, officially ubiquitous. You know, it used to be something only for specialized movies, and it used to be that people were a little bit cautious about using, you know, pronounced or extremely stylized digital or intermediate looks on films. And now, of course, all that caution has gone to the wind. Now every movie has a DI, and nobody thinks twice about doing a pretty extreme color correction at the end of a film. And yet these two really important processes don't get to interact with one another at all. A director is asked to finalize a visual effects shot before they ever get to sit down in a DI theater. So they're asked to final it maybe on film or on some sort of digital playback device with some sort of vague idea that then there will be subsequent color correction. And then, of course, the color correction happens crammed into a few weeks at the end of production where you're paying by the hour to be in a suite with an A-list color correction artist, and you're redesigning the look of your film with a bunch of shots that have been taken offline and taken out of production by all the visual effects houses. And I think anyone listening to this who's in the industry will probably have had the experience of getting the call from your show visual effects supervisor saying, you know what, we're sitting in the DI and there's something wrong with 100 of your shots, you know, that I didn't notice until I discovered that the director actually wanted to tint them all bright blue, you know. And so that's just terrifying and kind of problematic to me, and I had written about it, and then of course found myself in the situation where I was being invited to solve that problem. So I pitched, you know, Frank and Deborah on the idea of doing the DI at the orphanage, with of course the notion that we would have a final polish, you know, in a true DI theater, that they would have the last looks, you know, in a place that could really guarantee that what we were seeing on the screen was going to look, you know, was going to be matched by a particular lab, which none of which at the time had been established. So we set out this pipeline where we would do 90% of the grade at the orphanage and save the last 10% for the end of the process. And that actually worked out brilliantly. It was terrific to have that, and terrific to have Aaron Rhodes be the consistent pair of eyeballs who had been there every day on the set and then carried that through to the end.
So now we've discussed the DI, but even with terrific DOP, even with a great cast like Samuel Jackson and others, you've still got shots that you were shooting in green screen that involved, notwithstanding those dry for wet, you actually had sort of mud shots and a whole lot of other shots that were wet and outfits that, you know, clearly were reflective and shiny and difficult to key. So what was the sort of actual keying pipeline, and how did you get around some of those what must have been really tricky keying problems?
Yeah, I mean, we did the best we could. One of the early, you know, one of the decisions that you have to make with a movie like this is how you do your tracking markers and that perennial kind of compromise between trackability and keyability. The decision we made on this film was to use, wherever possible, to use green lasers aimed at the green screens, in part because of Bill's shooting style. We wanted everyone to be fast and nimble. Bill operates the camera himself. He's a very intuitive camera operator, and it's one of the real gifts that he brings to the film. I didn't want to... once I saw that in action, it became very clear to me that it would be a huge mistake to even try to slow that down in any way. So we had a great kind of visual effects team of PAs with these rigs that we called Medusa rigs, because they basically were aimable... bendy arms with green laser pointers attached to them, and we could very quickly fly in a cloud of green laser dots into the background of any shot, even if Bill had gone and changed lenses on us quicker than anyone has a right to expect the lens to be changed on a movie set. And
that does so actually require the green screen to be very stable, because I've tried that, and if you're putting up flats that are solid, that's great, but if you're hanging green screens, that doesn't really work very well, does it?
Yeah, that's correct. And we did oftentimes have fans blowing on the set, and at those times we would have to bring in other rigs. We had, you know, arms preloaded with LEDs and that kind of thing. I'm a big fan of these self-illuminated tracking markers, though, because they do a couple of things to help you out. They give you an accurate report of what the circle of confusion, you know, what the bokeh characteristic is of the defocus at a given distance, you know, that is often not that dissimilar from where your real backgrounds are going to wind up, or your CG backgrounds are going to wind up. So they were a great cue for that. But yeah, I mean, it is hard. And that is, again, that kind of, you know, notion that I'm sure no one listening to this podcast subscribes to, but unfortunately that some people in the film biz do, that green screen is kind of a panacea. You get cured of that real quick when you realize that, you know, I mean, the sort of bad cop mandate that I laid down is that if there's not a tracking marker in the shot, it's not in the can, you know, and everyone, you know, took that to heart and understood it. The other thing that was nice was that by having this high contrast LUT that turned the green screen gray, it made any flaw in the green screen pop out on the onset monitors. All and right. So it was a nice just kind of living, breathing incentive to get the green screens extremely clean. But nevertheless, you know, we obviously did have our challenging situations, especially with splashing water and mud and that kind of thing. And I left it to, you know, we haven't quite talked about the structure of who did what on the film, but you know, in addition to the orphanage itself being in production on this movie, we had 9 other facilities around the world working on the movie, all you know, overseen from the sort of command central at the orphanage, and
I think including some in my own hometown, actually.
That is correct. Yeah,
and you're monitoring all that using CineSync, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. I left it up to them in terms of developing their individual keying pipelines, but we had a lot of conversations about best practices there, and I think probably the only thing that I tried to lay down was just that green spill is your friend, you know. And we would have a lot of the things that we would take the time to build practically would be things like a pit of mud, a pool of water, or a wet cobblestone street. You know, all of those things are going to be viewed obliquely by the camera, glancing off into a brightly illuminated green screen, which means they're going to be rife with spill. And I did some early tests with some of the first shots to come back to try to show the various vendors how that was not a mistake, but was in fact going to be their greatest gift, because that spill is telling you how their digital environment ought to be reflected in our practical sets.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I've often said that in the real world, there is a contribution to whatever's happening by the, quote, backing, which may be just blue sky, and removing it to gray is the wrong thing to do.
That's exactly right, and I think we've all seen shots like that where you just kind of feel that green screen curse on them, and as compositors, you know, you and I are familiar that you're always looking for any opportunity to find that integration, to have the layers of a shot talk to each other in the way that layers of reality do, and there's a lot of kind of, you know, there's things like light wrap and color correction that we do to try to do that stuff, but none of those solutions are as good as the real thing, and Greenspill is the real thing. It's a living, breathing record of how the background wanted to contaminate the foreground, and we embraced it, and it actually became a part of our signature look, a part of how we were able to put that Frank Miller look on the screen, because he's such a master of silhouette, Frank, that he's comfortable with partial silhouette, which I think is the real, you know, gutsiness of his type of image making and where he is visually most compatible with Bill Pope. The idea that a character's face would bleed off into black and that in fact you would put no light on the background there either, so that you lose the distinction of where their silhouette stops. And that's, I think, the thing that a lot of comic book artists try to emulate about Frank's artwork that no one can get as good as he does, is that way that the silhouettes hint at the image and they cause the image to be formed inside your head as the viewer, as opposed to just sit there on the screen allowing you to passively let them flip by. You have to look at a Sin City page. Your brain gets engaged by a Sin City page, and that is really the visual phenomenon that we were seeking to emulate here. So you'll see shots of Sam Jackson covered with mud, staring into the lens, and the side of his head is completely rimlit, and rather than put that white Sam Jackson head edge against a black background, you know, we made the choice to say, well, there's a rim light back there, and it's nighttime, and it's snowing, and it's foggy out. That rim light is going to hit that atmosphere and light it up. I'm going to put him against white. And now you've got the white edge of Sam Jackson against an all-white background, and the dark edge on the other side of the frame against a dark background. And suddenly you've got an image where you can't tell where Sam starts and where the background stops, and you're starting to create a Frank Miller type of image. And you're doing so by allowing the green spill to help blur the line between the foreground and the background.
And just in terms of because we've moved on to sort of a creative discussion, I will come back and ask a couple more technical questions, but the backgrounds, obviously a lot of it is being added in post and it's part of the production design, but there is no clear date for the time period that this is in, is that right? I mean, because it seems to be a mix of helicopters and 1940s wardrobe kind of thing. Is that...
Yeah, that's fair to say. I mean, there's sort of a Frank Miller policy on that stuff, which is fun to, you know, one of the great things about working with Frank is that he's as good at talking about this stuff as he is at doing it. It's rare that you work with creative visionaries who are actually good at describing what they do, and he just has a really simple answer to that. If he needs a police car, if he needs a phone, if he needs a lamppost or a street or a building, he just, you know, goes back through history and finds the one that looks the coolest, and he uses that. And it's such a great policy, you know. So you've got a cop talking on a cell phone and then hopping in a police car from the 50s. You know, you've got cops with six guns, and then you've got SWAT teams with MP5s, you know. And when it's time for the helicopters to show up, well, the medevac helicopter is Sikorsky from the 70s, but the SWAT team helicopters are Apaches, you know. And it's just great because it's just a simple rule that works every time. Whatever looks the coolest, use that.
Yeah, I mean, it is obviously extremely graphic, and I mean that in the sense of graphical. The other thing I think is of interest aesthetically is that one of the great tools in the hands of a graphic novelist is the frame, because they don't have to have, you know, panes in the traditional cartoon sense that are all the same size and all the same aspect ratio, but you are kind of locked into the same aspect ratio on film. Did you discuss that at all, like trying to get the illusion of having more vertical frames than just your standard horizontal? Do you know what I'm saying? Referring to like how he's actually done it in the graphic novels?
Yeah, I think that was a thought, you know, that Robert and I certainly discussed during Sin City was whether we would ever, you know, panelize the frame or try to kind of, you know, to break up the frame or change aspect ratios. I know that, you know, that's something that, for instance, Genndy Tartakovsky did a lot with the Samurai Jack cartoon series, was that he would just randomly change aspect ratios on you as the whim suited him, depending on what the individual shot required. But based on our idea that the spirit is a much more cinematic, cinematographic kind of an exercise, we made a choice early on, a couple of important choices early on. One was that we were going to, you know, go for a CinemaScope aspect ratio, and another that we would hard mat to CinemaScope in post, so that there would never be, you know, it's as if we had shot anamorphic. In other words, there's no pan and scan version that shows you more of the frame than was ever there in the 235 master. I know that, you know, Frank printed up storyboard templates for himself that had that aspect ratio, and I made some as well, and we had them scattered everywhere, and we all just got in the habit of drawing to fill that kind of a frame. And I'm sure there were times where, you know, Frank viewed that as a limitation, but the great thing about Frank is that he understands that limitations are what spur creativity, and there was never any complaint about aspect ratio or suggestion that we should try to defy it in any way.
And so if that was a sort of a negative, but a restriction or a change from the comic books in one respect, was there anything that you could sort of point to that went the other way, that now you're in the position of having moving images that you think that Frank or the production in general managed to sort of, you know, come up with some new visual language that couldn't be done in a comic book or a graphic novel?
Well, I think, you know...
You mentioned a lot of slow motion, for example.
Yeah, I mean, you know, time is obviously, you know, there's interesting things about comic books in terms of their similarities to photography, that you pick a signature moment and you represent everything with one instant, you know. You don't get that with film, but what the Phantom camera provided us was the opportunity to allow one moment to linger. So, for instance, there's a shot... there's a storyboard that Frank drew that is just this beautiful image that I wanted to, that I just cherished, that was the spirit's boot perfectly framed in the center of frame, and the bottoms of Octopus's boots straddling it, and a screen full of flying mud. And it perfectly stated that the octopus had just been kicked in the face with brutal force and had flipped backwards, and that the spirit was still flying through the air. And, you know, as second unit director working with the stunt team, that fell to myself and John Medlin, the stunt coordinator, to figure out how the heck we were going to do that. And we shot that shot at 800 frames per second.
Wow.
So we actually got that image, you know, to linger on the frame. And and so you actually do kind of get to have these little moments where you wink and nod and show sort of almost a moving hold of a storyboard or a comic book image on the frame.
You spoke about lighting budgets before, but getting up to 800, you must have had to cut a couple of extra lights out of the truck for that.
Yeah, exactly. that camera's terrific, but it can't break the laws of physics, so you definitely have to pour the light on for that. There were only a couple times where we ever went that high. And oftentimes, you know what, we would... Because it was easy enough to do, we would go higher than we'd oftentimes go higher by an order of magnitude than what we think we would need. So if we thought that it looked good at 400, we'd shoot it at 800, and that way the editor has a choice of speeding it up if he chooses. And oftentimes that's what was done, but we tried to at least, if we tested a speed that we thought was effective, we would then try to either shoot, we'd try to shoot an even increment, you know, double or triple that speed, so that we could always do a clean speed up if we needed to.
And I assume at that high frame rate, the concept of sort of matching the shutter angle becomes a bit less relevant, because it's no longer, you know, you're getting almost every frame relatively motion blur free, I presume.
Yeah, that's right. That is a phenomenon that happens when you make the decision to potentially double speed a shot. You are also making a decision to effectively wind up with a possibly 90 or 45 degree shutter angle, and that was something we tested early on, and we determined that we were all totally fine with that. That the crisper narrow shutter effect was in fact, quite a complement to the idea of these sort of frozen moments.
And now, I just have to get back to the technical, because otherwise I'd get shot by our listeners. But we never actually discussed how you were keying at the orphanage. Like, what was the pipeline? How were you? If we just go into some of the geeky technical stuff, what was your primary pipeline?
Well, for the shots that the orphanage themselves did, we did all of the work in Nuke. And you know, keying with the variety of solutions that come along with that, you know, so it's and yet, you know, as is always the case, there's always a complement of roto going on with any kind of green screen endeavor. So a very active paint and roto department there to clean tracking markers out of hair and things like that. There's just those kinds of things are unavoidable. In Nuke, we developed our own custom, you know, import node that had the Panavision log to lin conversion, doing all the compositing work in linear light, and then going back out to Panalog on the way out. Panalog was the kind of the currency, you know, color space of everything, except for the phantom shots, which were converted to a gamma encoded color space instead of Panalog. And if I had it all to do over again, I probably would have changed that. But we did publish a color pipeline guideline, and that kind of gets back again to not wanting to try to mandate any particular pipeline. We had nine facilities in addition to the orphanage working on the movie, and I know that they were using everything from, I think we had, you know, Shake, Fusion, Flame, After Effects, and Nuke, all being used on the show, and all producing visually similar results. Part of that was because of the way that we were able to, you know, hand out this work from the facility that we built at the orphanage for this project called The Bunker, which is just we took over one production suite. We moved the DI theater into a room that, you know, by any measure is probably a little bit too small for what we were using it for. But we wanted everything to be we wanted first and foremost to be able to ensure, you know, Oddlot Entertainment and Lionsgate that we were being very secure, because we were going to have their entire film at our facility. So we created a special kind of, you know, card key lockdown for just this one part of the facility. And we called it The Bunker in no small part because we are in a redone, military headquarters building in the Presidio in San Francisco, but also because we do have the 18 inch thick, cement walls to back it up, but we also had a lot of, you know, IT related security, and we basically kind of firewalled off the bunker from the rest of the orphanage. And in that way, you know, the bunker became, you know, the command central for the whole film, and the orphanage itself as a vendor on the movie was really treated in no way any differently than any of the, you know, than Riot or Rising Sun or Fuel or Digital Dimension. Any of the other visual effects vendors that worked on the movie, the orphanage was just one of them. The orphanage had its own visual effects supervisor, Rich McBride, and its own crew, completely separate from the bunker crew. And in a long-winded way, I'm getting back to the answer to your question, which is that there's a good reason to house your visual effects, you know, as opposed to how it's usually done out of a trailer somewhere or out of some grubby offices in a studio backlot. To house your visual effects production out of a visual effects house, you know, you've got on the production side, the vendors are speaking to Nancy and her crew, who are used to, you know, who are speaking their language, who are giving them the turnover sheets and the scheduling information in that they want in the format that they wanted. And then on the visual and technical side that we're interested in, I was able to give these vendors everything that I had ever always wanted as a visual effects vendor for my part. You know, I gave a huge color pipeline document that detailed in every last nuance of how the Mash 4 LUT was created, sample images, DPX files that showing every stage of the processing tree. We had sample After Effects projects, Shake scripts, Nuke scripts that we were able to pass around. We had a series of images that I called the Pipeline Buster that were images designed to show us in no uncertain terms if a QuickTime movie was at the wrong gamma or if it was clipping off 16 to 235 when it shouldn't be. And so we, you know, the very first step for each vendor was to daily the Pipeline Buster sequence and send it back to us. And, you know, some of them got it right on the first try and some of them got it right on the 10th try. But at the end of the day, I was able to get, you know, QuickTime dailies from each of these 10 vendors that all looked exactly the same. And I was able to then project them on the same projector in the DI theater. We had it switching back and forth between a Mac workstation and the Nucota Filmmaster. So the same screen that I was doing CineSync dailies on with the 10 vendors, I would also then switch over and do 2K DI on that same screen.
But I mean, the Lin workflow that you yourself sort of pioneered and the eLin stuff pre, you know, yeah, the last couple of After Effects, that's to a certain extent a little easier to do in this world, in a compositing environment. Some of the 3D Maya Max kind of stuff doesn't necessarily... But as I guess, does that even affect you because you were getting the images after they'd been comped?
Yeah, that's correct. And I actually, you know, uncharacteristically, with each project, I kind of pick my battles. And internally at the orphanage, I can always kind of work with a crew and say, this is going to be the project where we do this right, or, you know, where we try to break this new, you know, break down this limitation or try to solve this problem. With staring down the barrel of 1,900 shots in 10 facilities, I was not going to ask anyone to step completely outside of their comfort zone. So I didn't mandate that my vendors work in a linear light workflow. And in fact, I know for certain that several of them composited in log. Now, if folks are used to doing that, they tend to develop tricks to make that work, you know. But I would be the first one to point out if I saw something that seemed like the kind of artifact that is commonly associated with that. And since we were doing a lot of compositing of things like, you know, out of focus falling snow and other kinds of, you know, that's one that where I think the sort of log compositing gotchas can really creep in. The other one is spinning helicopter blades, because if you composite in log and render in log or video space, spinning helicopter blades can look too dark over a light background. So, you know, I would certainly be have my eye on things like that, but there were two reasons why I couldn't be the kind of visual effects supervisor who tries to dictate a pipeline. One was that it was just too daunting and we had too much work to do in too short an amount of time for me to say, I want you to do the impossible and I also want you to do it with this brand new pogo stick that I just bought for you. And the other one was that I wanted to stay true to my original intent and something that I promised the vendors when I was, you know, interviewing them to work on the project, which is that this was not going to be a project about technology, that this was going to be a project about art, that this was going to be a movie where we would spend all of our time talking about how to make things look great. and we would focus on aesthetics, you know, because there really isn't, you know, there's no, you know, cruise ships tipping over or dinosaurs chewing each other to bits in this movie. There really isn't anything in it that should be that technically difficult. But so in terms of picking our challenges, I was more interested in coming to work every day trying to think of ways to make the film more beautiful, not to make it look more realistic. Frank is famous for saying that he's never been accused of realism. And so, you know, why should I be concerned with it? It's far more interesting to me at this stage in my career to concern myself on a day-to-day basis with how to make things look great.
And just in that respect, with the backgrounds, because, you know, it's not New York, but obviously it looks a bit like a New York or a Chicago. Where was all of that coming from? Were you trying to access lots of live-action elements or stills and put those together for matte paintings? Was it all 3D? What was the... Because, I mean, a lot of that building environment is a heck of a lot of architecture to sort of...
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the early conversations Frank and I had was we realized that we both have this amazing love for New York. Frank lives there. I have family who live there, and I visit whenever I can. I made two trips to New York over the course of the production of the movie and shot, you know, thousands of photographs there, and have over the last 10 years shot many thousands of photographs there. My first directing job was in New York and was, in fact, a music video wherein I got to present a bit of a little kind of mini sexy architectural history of New York. So talking about that with Frank, we both agreed that we were making a thinly disguised love letter to New York, which is kind of a proud tradition in filmmaking that dates back maybe as far as to, you know, the movie Naked City, which we were both fans of. I met Frank in New York for coffee once, and we walked around and walked through his neighborhood, and I brought my camera and took a lot of photos, and some of those images are in the movie, are the basis of, you know, matte paintings that are in the film. Seeing New York through Frank's eyes, you see that New York is not, you know, it's sort of the common thing that people talk about when they're talking about doing a science fiction film, that you don't replace every building with the shiny chrome, you know, futuristic building. That when the future happens, they don't tear down the past, you know. And you can really see when you look at a movie like Naked City that has all these beautiful skyline shots of how New York looked in the 40s, that the New York as it stands right now, all that stuff still exists, or most of it does. It's just had a bunch of glass and steel kind of glum. And I just walking with Frank and seeing New York through his eyes, I realize he doesn't see that stuff. You know, so Central City, in the spirit, is basically New York through Frank's eyes, and his passion for that city is so palpable, and it's something that I share so deeply. And we both have a fascination with making ugly things beautiful. He lives in a pretty rough and tumble neighborhood, and the view out of his studio is a gigantic wall of a building that looks, you know, by most people's imaginations, probably pretty spooky and creepy. To me, it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. I took 100 photos of it, and it became a part of, you know, one of the most important sequences in the film related to the city. So, you know, and I was able to, thankfully, in my time in New York, get up on some rooftops and take some photos of water towers and things like that that are kind of the signature visuals that you see in some of the teaser trailers and whatnot. And, you know, I guess, you know, when I told Frank that I had a library of, you know, of 10 years of digital photography of New York, you know, I think that was when we kind of realized that we had found the right, you know, collaborators on this project. In fact, Frank's credit in the opening credits of the movie is over a matte painting that was based on a location scout photo that I took for that music video that I directed in 2001.
I was just going to say, it does sound like the whole process was incredibly collaborative, and as it should be. And we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about it today. Thank you so much, Stu.
Oh, it is my sincere pleasure, Mike. As you know, thank you very much for having me on the show.
And, we're looking forward to where it goes from here. I don't think we've seen the end of this style of very graphic filmmaking. I think it's really found its place and its audience. So thank you again.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. And thanks, Stu, for taking the time to do this interview. I recently had a chance to work at the orphanage for a few months and work with Stu and Aaron and meet the crew there. And I think I was actually in the bunker at that point, which was now converted to other use. Anyway, it was great. And Stu's always been very generous with his knowledge. The DV Rebel book I mentioned before, his personal knowledge on the Prolost blog. I mean, just really helping to share photography information and cinematography and pushing manufacturers for features on cameras and stuff has been fantastic. And of course their contribution at the orphanage to Elin and what eventually got built into After Effects for compositing is just outstanding. So we really appreciate Stu's contributions overall and for helping us out with this podcast. So that'll do it for this FX podcast. For Mike Seymour in Sydney, Australia, John Montgomery in Chicago, Illinois, I'm Jeff Huser, well in Cincinnati right now, but heading back to Los Angeles soon. Thanks for joining us.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.